Okay, see, like, your trouble with this situation is that it's not medieval in any respect. Like, this is kind of like the modern Omni Shambles of Britain. But what we've done here is we've kind of like there you have the medieval structures in place, but we strapped this whole other edifice on top of it. So yeah, it's like that. Like, if you see that with like churches here sometimes, like you'll have a medieval church in the background, but then it's got a facade that is like Baroque, and that's literally our government. So yeah, it's great.
I can see that. Yeah, I don't yeah, I don't know. I don't know what's gonna happen.
I have
It's,
no fucking clue, homie. I have no idea. Like, I've got some good friends visiting me from Kentucky right now, and they're like, "Can you explain this?" And I'm like, "No,
No.
not really." I was like, "And no one in this fucking country can explain to you what's going on right now. We're all just kind of like, huh." But
Yeah.
this is what happens when you basically like we've essentially had like the same party in power for decades upon decades. Like, I mean, there was Tony Blair, but he was also a Tory. So, meh. Like,
It's yeah,
everything's
it's
falling apart, and a bunch of us are gonna die this winter because we can't afford fuel. So things are going pretty good.
yeah, I think one of the most interesting things I'm seeing right now in the world, or at least in America, and to some extent England. I mean, obviously I don't follow nearly as many English people as I do Americans, but or people who live in England, but it's like that normal people are starting to come to the conclusion that the current system, working within this current system to any degree, is not going to get anything changed. Like, it, I mean, on the one hand, like, America is the Supreme Court has decided, they've said, fuck it, let's be legends, we're gonna do it, and we're just going full-throated theocracy. But then and there's just no response from the Democratic Party, and yeah, there are talks of like primarying Biden and stuff like that. And I mean, like, that would, definitely give the Democrats a better chance of winning. And I mean, but at the same time, like, the Democrats winning is like, it's bad. Like,
Well, I mean that.
even with someone like Pritzker or Gavin Newsom, and if you're not familiar with American politics, don't worry about it. But these are just two governors from states, and like, their thing is basically that they kind of did the stuff that they said they were going to do, which for Democrats is basically unheard of. That's the low bar that we're working with here. And so it's like, you got these guys, and it's like, what are, I mean, like, if you get them in and, like, you like try to make some changes to the court and everything like that, okay, but like, the court is still there. You still got the same huge problems. You're still working within the same exact neoliberal order that has been around and is now dying. And it's like, Republicans have decided that they're going to kill the golden egg.
Oh
They
yeah,
don't care.
absolutely. They
That's
don't
what they're going
care.
to do. And that was like unheard of to everyone, like, until maybe a couple of years ago. And now they've just decided they're going to kill it. So if they're going to kill it, something has to change. Like, something has to change. Something has to happen. And one thing about America is there are way more people here who, like, don't like this theocratic bullshit than there are people who do. A whole lot more of them. And another fun thing is that our police seem to be very scared of doing anything. I'm not saying that they're not going to try to kill you, because that's obviously false. But I'm saying that they're scared of one guy. They're scared to go in to get one guy out of a school, and so they just all stand there, even though they're all wearing bulletproof shit. And so, like, yeah, these guys are a bunch of what's the word I'm looking for? Cowards, pussies, whatever. Maybe I'm sorry. Pussies may be offensive. Cowards, whatever you want to call them. But yeah, it's so it's like, I don't know what's gonna happen. I have no idea.
Who
I have
knows?
absolutely no clue. This
Who?
place is wild. Like, I don't know. I have no idea, but I do have faith in people to try, at least.
Yeah.
That's you know, if you try and fail, at least you tried. You know? I mean, like that. I mean, it's like it's better than not doing anything. And I mean that, you know, that's the that's the thing.
Yeah,
I
think,
you know, people, you know, people when confronted with the reality of how shitty the situation is just, you know, they're just going to end up. You know,
yeah,
I don't know.
We're in the stupidest of all possible fucking timelines. And, you know, that.
Yeah,
that means that we've got a lot of questions and we don't really know what's going to happen. And, you know, your guess is as good as mine, right? Like, not a lot of precedent for any of this. So, hey.
Yeah, no clue.
Yeah,
I don't. I don't know. I don't think Boris Johnson going anywhere is.
Oh God, no! I don't. No, but it's like I do know weird centrists that I've spoken to who have been like, oh well, you know, yeah, but there's competent Tories, and you know, they want what's best for the country, even if I don't agree with it. And I was like, yeah, but what they want is to literally kill all of the poor, and if they're competent, they just do that more effectively. Like that's not a good thing. So it literally doesn't, it does not make a difference at all whatsoever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. One of the positive signs I've seen in America recently is people being like, Biden, you know, be like, well, the sensible Republicans are going to come back, and people are like, there are none of them.
There are no sensible Republicans. You're fucking
terrible at this. There are no sensible Tories. These people, like,
they're ghouls.
These people at a base level think that probably think that you are some form of pederast who like sacrifices and eats children and does satanic rituals with your secret like gay lovers and all stuff like that. And I'm not saying that to say like to reinforce that. I'm saying that like these people believe that shit about you at a basic level. And if they do, that means that there's nothing you can do to talk that. Like, what are you going to do? Talk them out of the fact that they think that you, like, drink baby brain? Like, I mean, like, really? Like, you can't.
This is extremely it, right? Like, we're. There's this kind of, like, myth, you know, both here and America, because, you know, America watched it by learning the UK, you know, norms will kick in. And that there's like that some form of politesse is going to like pull us all through this. Mm-hmm. And then that's going to be what's okay. And it's just like, but they don't care anymore. And also, I'm really tired of that whole idea of like, oh, yeah, but well, if you're just polite about it, like, you know, the rehabilitation of George Bush in the States where it's like he killed 3 million people. He destabilized the entire Middle East. And you're like, oh, but he was polite. Fuck out of here. I don't care if he was polite. Same thing with here. Like, there's this rehabilitation now of Theresa May, who was the prime minister before Boris Johnson. And it's like, she is the architect of what is called the hostile environment policy. The idea of which it was that it would be so unbearable to be an immigrant in this country that people would simply go back. They like she deported an entire generation of like black elders to their deaths in countries that they had never been to in their lives. Like she is a ghoul and a monster. And everyone is all like, oh, yeah, girl boss. Oh, well, at least she was competent. And it's just like, I am losing my goddamn mind. Like, and, you know, stop trying to rehabilitate these people because, you know, they wore a suit in the correct manner. And, you know. We're polite. Yeah. It's just disgusting, you know.
Yeah, it's there no norm or institution that exists, at least not in America or Britain. I'm sure there might be some in other countries, but here, none of these institutions and none of these norms are going to save anyone. And I mean, if these people have already, you know, entered the death drive, and they're just going to do whatever they have, then, you know, like, there's no point in trying to keep the system intact. The system is rotten to the core, and all it does is reinforce the power and hegemony of these people. Who are going to kill the planet? Who are going to kill us? Who are going to kill everyone? Because they're not going to stop at you know, abortions or women's rights or gay people or you know, trans people or women or black people there, or communist or socialist or anybody to the left of like fucking Ronald Reagan or someone, they're not going to stop until they get all of that. Yep. And accommodating that up to a point, you know, I mean, there's a famous quote about that. You know, they came for somebody and I didn't do, you know, like there's a famous quote about that. And I'm not making light of that fact. That's what they're going to do. You're not going to get, I mean, I think we talked about the other day, you're not going to get anywhere with these people by like appeasing, by trying to appease them, or like, you know, be like, oh, okay, well, you know, they did a, you know, it's okay because, you know, we'll just throw trans people, you know, like Hillary Clinton said, you know, basically like, let's throw trans people under the bus to try and like get some good governance. And it's like, well, first of all, that is like a heinous thing to say to about any group. It's heinous to like think of people like so in such crass economic terms like that. But at the same time, I mean, like, that's not how you do things, because if you sacrifice, because from a logical standpoint, if you sacrifice them, you're just going to have to sacrifice somebody else and somebody else and somebody else. Because if you've noticed, the conservatives in the English speaking world have gone from like, you know, the like quasi libertarian, you know, we don't like this stuff. You know, we might do something weird or extreme, but.
Yeah.
For the most part, it's rhetoric to like, okay, fuck it. We're like 100%. We're taking all the rights away. We don't care. We're killing the golden egg. We're just going to destroy everything that we have to so that we can rule this planet the way that we want to for like however little time it has left, so God can come back and save us all, or, you know, whatever flavor that they have.
Oh, God. Yeah.
And you're never going to appease them out of that. They're like, I'm preaching to the choir. Like, there's nobody who's listening to this who's
I gotta get it off my chest before I start doing history, because all I've been doing all fucking week is just like being glued to screens watching the Tory party do whatever the fuck this is. And I mean, it's interesting, right? Because so on Saturday I'm making some TV show, and they want to talk to me about William the Conqueror and how that kind of like sets up the monarchy generally.
Oh, Billy.
Yeah. And it's like, it's literally where it comes from. It's just like, that's here, you know, the stage was set for who controls the country. And it was this tiny cadre of, you know, like five people who like own all of the land. They have all of the money. We have a completely obsequious and subservient press class. Like hilariously, just before this, I was watching the news and then I went to record this, and one of the things the commentator said was, oh, the battle for the soul of the Conservative Party continues. And it's like, what soul? Like, there is no soul. And there doesn't have to be, because the way that people in this country act is as though it's kind of a natural law that the Tories rule us all. And, you know, we've no hope in sight. And, you know, I poke around in the dustbins and look at the history all the time, but like, yo, It's very weird living through this incredibly stupid timeline. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Watching, you know, watching this stuff fall apart in real time is definitely interesting.
Well, I mean, here, you know, like literally we chose this because the nice jam granddad was going to bring up middle class people's taxes by $5 a month. And we couldn't have that. So...
Nope. The neoliberal order cannot suffer the people getting anything, because then the people get, you know, they get delusions of grandeur and they get, you know, they get to thinking they're above their station.
Anyway, you want to talk about history?
Do you want to count this down? I'll count this down and clap, and then we can just use this as a cold open or whatever.
Yeah, great.
And people can enjoy it.
That's right.
All
right,
3, 2, 1. Thank you. Hello, and welcome back to We're Not So Different, a podcast about how we've always been idiots. My name is Luke. I'm an amateurish historian. As always, I'm joined by Dr. Eleanor Yanega, who is anything but. In this episode, we're going to go back to talking a bit about cities, talking about, this time we're going to be talking about London and Paris. So that is exciting. But before we get there, we have a question from one of our patrons, Ghost Robot 23. Hey, all, longtime lurker, first time poster. Well, thank you. I was wondering if there was any organized attempt at preserving historical sites in the Middle Ages. I've been traipsing along part of the Antonine Wall recently, and I find it pretty interesting that people have basically lived on top of it since the Romans left without it being completely demolished.
So this is a really interesting question, because the answer is, like, in terms of organized attempts, no, but I've got more to say about it than that. And there's a reason for that. And it's because the idea of kind of conservation and preservation of historical sites is a really modern one. And it's really tied in a lot of ways to sort of Victorian ideas about museums and preservation and things like that. So the idea that you need to kind of keep things intact and ideally in situ, but, you know, this sort of kind of drive to uncover archaeological spots, things like that. So that's one half. It's a modern thing to be like, oh gosh, oh cool, we found an old palace, let's keep it. But having said that, the medieval urge here is to be alongside these things because they're seen as being incredibly important, right? So they don't attempt to preserve things, but they're like, oh, this is the thing. So I wrote about this for my blog Patreon last week, but I was just up at this old site, early medieval palace site called Ad Geffryn up in Northumberland, which I'm always keep accidentally calling Northumbria because the kingdom was called Northumbria and I keep fucking it up. So Ad Geffryn is this cool site where the kings of Northumbria, their summer palace was. And the reason their summer palace is there is because there was an Iron Age fort there. And before that, there was a henge. And there's all these like Iron Age burial grounds. And there's all these, you know, there's tons of historical stuff. And so they put their palace there because they understand it to be an important place historically. And so in order to prove that you are a king, you also have to control this place that was important historically and where, you know, important people lived. So there's this thing about kind of like gluing these things together. And then what's really, really cute about these people is when they built their little summer palace, they built an amphitheater. So like they were like also copying the Romans. And this is in like the 7th century. So, like, they're super conscious about the past, and they're kind of trying to align themselves with the past and always show that they are kind of, like, the worthy successors of the past because they understand and control it. But it's a lot more about, like, living on top of things or living alongside of things. So just like you said, Ghost Robot, like, you know, everyone kind of, like, living on top of the Antonine Wall, right? Like, you'll see this in all sorts of places. For example, like in Split, you have Diocletian's palace and the old walls are there and there's like apartment buildings in them. And people recognize that these are important and, you know, that it gives the city a sort of gravitas, but they also kind of use them. And, you know, you see this all the time in terms of where you see churches placed or where you see castles or palaces placed. So it's just a different way of being incredibly interested in the past and wanting to connect to it. So it's not about preservation. It's about kind of continuation. And actually, there's going to be some stuff to talk about it this week when we launch into the show. So yeah, really good question. Yeah. Love that question.
Ghost Robot, thank you so much for the question. And as always, if you want to ask us questions like those or talk to us in the Discord or just listen to our bonus episodes, you can do that at patreon.com/WNSDpod. Subscribe for just $5 a month. Helps the show. All that stuff. It is great. But yeah, anyway, on to the main show, you know, after that extended cold open earlier. after a break last time to talk about abortion, we're coming back to talk more about medieval cities by comparing and contrasting two great medieval rivals, Paris and London, despite starting from similarly humble origins as former Roman provincial cities. Each took wildly different paths toward becoming world capitals, and the Parisians would have probably bristled at even being compared to London, let alone called rivals. But if the French wanted to prevent that, they shouldn't have lost all those big name battles during the Hundred Years' War and given the English delusions of grandeur that we're all still paying for to this day. That's right, I'm laying this all at the feet of the French. I'm just kidding. While it is true that London was practically abandoned after the Romans withdrew from Britannia and the city struggled to be seen as a true center of culture and commerce due to England's status as a global backwater for most of the Middle Ages, it is also true to say that by the end of the medieval era, London was a rival to Paris, even if it was still decidedly the little brother in the relationship. So in this episode, we're going to go through a high-level history of London and Paris during the Middle Ages, tracing their evolutions from discarded Roman cities to flourishing worldwide centers of culture, economics, politics, and thought. We'll also talk a bit about the relationships the two cities had with one another, because they were at times friendly with alliances sealed through marriage, and at other times they were at open war. Hell, for a long time, the English kings near London were vassals to the French kings in Paris, and that makes for interesting political dynamics. So come with us and travel back to a time before it was the best of times and the worst of times. See, I only made one A Tale of Two Cities.
I love
reference.
It. I was wondering if you were going to get one in. Yeah, all right.
And let's talk about London and Paris. I've never read all of it. I was forced to read part of it in school, and that soured me on it forever, even though Dickens is, you know, an incredible writer.
Yeah.
But yeah, never read it. Sorry. Yep.
We could do a down and out joke as well, obviously.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I'm down and out in only one of these cities on a regular basis, but
yeah. So Eleanor, please tell us about the Roman city Londinium at the fall of the Western Roman Empire.
Yeah, so, I mean, part of the fucking problem. I love this fucking... Okay, like, to be clear, I'm going to preface this, which, like, you know, as much trash as I talk about, you know, the English, you know, because of the centuries of oppression of my people, I do like this goddamn town. And this is very, it's an annoying thing to do because, like, you know, when I go other places in England, people try to explain things to me and then they'll be all like, oh, where are you from? And I'm always like, London. Like I really get my back up about it.
Yeah.
And then, someone will always say, oh, well, you know, London, that doesn't really count as England. And I'm always like, yeah, I know. And then they'll say something racist to me immediately. Then they'll be like, oh, you know, you can be on a bus in London. They'll always say, I don't want to sound racist, but, and I'm like, uh-huh, but you're gonna. Okay, wait for it. And then they'll say something to you like, well, you can be on a bus in London and you might be the only white face on it. And I'm like, yeah, that's why I like it. Anyway, the point being that, like,
it's a multicultural place.
Yeah.
Who knew, dog?
Damn. And, you know, is the Romans who started that quite famously, coming over here, colonizing. So you get your Londinium, and what have you. And so they abandoned it in the 5th century, because this is sort of like the furthest they go, and it isn't good for much. Right. Yeah. Like it's good for flexing. At the time that you control a lot of land, but it's like, what are you really bringing out of, you know, Anglia at the time? You know, not enough to, like, basically offset the cost. So anyway, the Romans fuck off. But there, and then after that, people aren't living in Londinium proper. There is an English settlement kind of nearby, and, you know, people kind of stay near to the city walls, and they'll, like, retreat to within the city walls if they get threatened. So pirates would frequently come up the Thames, stuff like that. And so it's like, oh, sweet, I'll get inside these walls, and that's fine. By the early 7th century, there is a new kind of London, which we call Lodewijk, which is about a mile west of Londinium. And that's kind of where, for any other Londoners in the chat, hey, that's kind of like where, it's where the Strand is now, like Aldwych and stuff like that. So that is kind of like where it starts. And then by the 670s, there is more of a port town kind of going a little bit further west again by what is kind of like now Covent Garden. And, like, basically around this point in time, what we call England was in a number of smaller kingdoms that we call the Heptarchy. So like it's that's I can't do them all, but I think it's like Essex, Sussex, Northumbria, Kent, some other English things. I don't fucking know. All right. And by the mid 6th century, London kind of gets incorporated into the Kingdom of Essex. And the Kingdom of Essex is pretty big. It goes kind of like up to St. Albans. And, you know, it even got down to Surrey and stuff for a while. Like Essex was big. And then Londinium kind of gets a little bit more, Ludovic gets a little bit more cred by the about 604. Because at that point, Sabert of Essex, great name, like bring back early English names. It's got an AE. Sabert, come on, come on with this. he converts to Christianity, and so as a result, the Pope is like, yes, Christians, and they send up a bishop for London, who's called Mellitus, and you know that works out pretty well for them because it means that they've got a cathedral, and people start going, oh shit, well maybe I want to convert to Christianity. Oh, they've got Christians. Ooh, like, you know, that's kind of like the thing, right? So the cathedral of kind of gets built, and like the legend is that they built it on top of a Roman temple, which was like a temple of Diana. But then like when we're rebuilding all the churches after everything burnt down, when Christopher Wren was rebuilding everything, they did find any fucking truth to the story at all. Basically it would have been like a small church. Like we're talking about a tiny kingdom, not a lot of people or whatever. Really all the money was kind of up in Northumbria and places like that at the time. But you know, this is a pretty good trading place and it's easy to get to because it's up the river. So that's fine. So basically, we think that original church might have even been destroyed because like the pagans came back after Sabert in 616. like the whole Christianizing thing didn't take immediately. And like for the majority of the 7th century, the majority of Ludovic is still pagan, to be honest. And like sometimes we had bishops, sometimes we didn't, whatever. And then eventually by 675, we kind of like get the Bishopric of London reestablished, but it's then underneath the Archbishop of Canterbury, whomst you may have heard of, right? And like Canterbury will kind of remain the most important thing. So then Ludovic comes under Mercian control around 670. Mercia is the one that you hear about a lot. There's all these legends of like Mercian kings yelling at the tide and stuff like that. And then then there are like disputes. So in the 8th century, it's under Wessex at that point in time. But we have it start to get recorded and like stuff about it because the Venerable Bede, he is very busy in the 8th century writing shit down. And he refers to Ludovic as a trading center for many nations who visit it by land and sea. And that's where the Vic comes in. So Vic means trading town. Right? So it's just like London trading town is what Ludovic means. So going forward, Vikings, bitch. So we get rather a few Vikings here. And that's like even more like profound, like in the 9th century, like 830 onwards. Oh my God, Vikings all the time. So it gets attacked in 842. That is described by chroniclers as a great slaughter. Nice. You know, like in 851, there was a raiding party that had 350 ships come up. And this kind of shows you like the thing about London and why people are in London in the first place, because it's a place where you can bring 350 fucking Viking ships up a river, right? So it's like really easy to kind of like where London is situated is the broadest part of the Thames that like you're still inland. So it's a great way to like take goods from inland and like get them out to the sea very quickly without too much work. So in 865, the Viking Great Heathen Army launches an invasion. Basically they overrun East Anglia, Mercia, Northumbria, and basically end up controlling most of England at the time. By 871, they get to London. And we think that they're the ones who kind of like went into the walls and started inhabiting them again, like for the first time. So the, like, the English people are outside them in Lidenvik, and they're like, oh, sweet, walls, right? And we don't exactly know how long the Vikings were in control. And then in 878, Alfred the Great, who is a West, like, from Wessex, defeats them in the Battle of Ethandun, forces Guthrum, their leader, to sue for peace. There's a treaty, and it divides England into, like, what we know as England, and then the Danelaw. And the Danelaw is kind of, like, up north. You have a lot more of that kind of, like, in York and stuff like that. Basically, the English are back in control by 886. And Alfred is like, okay, I guess we need to fortify towns. and this is when the term burghs comes in. So it's like burg, like Edinburgh and places like that. Like, although that's Scottish, but that means town in Old English. Mm. And so, like, they are like, all right, that's it. We're going back into the old Roman walls. We are going to, like, reestablish them. They build a new defensive ditch. They recut the walls. Basically, that sets the boundaries of what we now call the City of London and what is London for the majority of the medieval period. And then they're calling it at that time Ludenburg. So, like, because it's a defensive town now, right? So, So Ludenvik kind of, like, gets sort of, like, abandoned over in Aldwych, and that's where we get the name from, because the name turns to Aldwych, which eventually turns into Aldwych. There you go. There you go. There's some name shit for you. So basically, London then becomes kind of like a place where, like, a lot more trading is going on, and it's a lot more defensive, so it's you know, things are getting better. But there's still periodic Viking raids throughout this time. We have a big attack by Sven Forkbeard, one of the better named Vikings. it's like unsuccessfully attacked in 994, like over and over, right? So, eventually in 1013, there's a really, really long siege, and King Ethelred has to kind of, like, leave and, like, flee abroad, because that's how bad it is. And he doesn't get to come back in until the Norwegian king Olaf helps. And it's really interesting because we have a lot of things named after him, like churches and things still. So it's like you see a lot of Olaf stuff around the time. And, like, some of the Norse sagas, like, repeat this. But that's important. Like, it sounds like a detail, but it's important because we have some more Danes come in as a result and set up a settlement around what is now London Bridge. And also it kind of helps to explain what the fuck went on in 1066, right? The English kind of get control of things again. You get Edward Confessor come in 1042, and he's the one who builds Westminster Abbey, which whips, and he basically spends all the kingdom's money on making Westminster Abbey. It's just, like, absolutely ridiculous. It's consecrated in 1065. The Palace of Westminster is built over there, and that's kind of, like, up the river. It's sort of, like, west. But then, you know, Edward dies, and da-da-da-da, you have the invasion, right? In general, it's the invasion that really makes London a big fucking deal. So in 1066, you know, obviously a delegation after the Normans kill everyone down south, they're just marching Normans all around everywhere. And they come over to London, and everyone is all like, oh, like, hey, we're behind the walls. And then they're like, oh, there seems to be rather a lot of them. I see. So they just kind of give up. And as a result, William then grants London a charter in 1067. And what it does is it upholds the previous rights, privileges, and laws that, like, London has. But he also, like, builds a couple of royal forts around the riverfront in London. So, like, that's the Tower of London. And then a couple other castles. And then that's really great for London, because it's like, oh, man, there's, like, actual castles here. There's actual forts. That's going to go a long way against the whole Viking thing. And then in 1097, William Rufus, he's William the Conqueror's grandson, starts building Westminster Hall, and that becomes, you know, more of a palace. And that's when it's the royal connection to London really comes. So previous to then, like, London was important, but, you know, when, you know, you've got Mercia and you've got Essex and you've got Wessex and you've got all these other kingdoms. Like, having London as your central position doesn't make any sense. But if you are like, I am the king of England, all of it, you kind of get to choose where your capital is going to be. And they chose this because of, you know, the established Roman walls, right? So what we were talking about at the beginning, they're saying that, like, we are continuing this tradition. See, look, we know where the Roman walls are. We know what's good. And we're being like that, right? London gets more richer over the resulting years. So, like, King John in 1199 and 1215 grants special rights to London. So they London then gets self-government. And that means that, you know, we get to elect a mayor and stuff like that. And that's a big fucking deal, because what that allows is for the kind of merchant classes to start getting a foothold here. So, you know, previous to all of this, London existed, but because the capital was there's no idea of a capital for the early English kings, right? Like, maybe Winchester, you could maybe say that. But at this point forward, it's just London. Like, that's it. So basically, it's the 13th century onwards that really kind of mark it out as different. But then there's sort of two things going on here, because there's London, the city within the walls, and then there's Westminster, where the royal stuff is happening. So that's where the abbey is, that's where the palace is. And that is actually good for London, because it allows London to be like, we're the separate thing with a mayor. The king is nearby, but the king doesn't necessarily control us. Right.
Yeah.
So there is this specific kind of like governance thing that really stimulates trade. And it allows, you know, London to become kind of the thing that it is. So at this time in the medieval period, you only have the one bridge in and out of town, London Bridge. So I'm just kind of trying to give you a taste of like what things are. So you start, as the city gets larger and larger, things start to spill outside the wall. So I'm in the Barbican while we're recording this. So I'm really near Smithfields. I'm outside the walls, but I'm just outside the walls, right? So I'm not in London, but I'm over near the execution field. I'm over where, Wat Tyler's rebellion ended because the mayor killed him, things like this. But it also kind of explains to you why things like the peasant revolt focus on London, right? Because this is where all the rich people are. This is where, like, the seats of royal power are. This is everybody still has a kind of foothold here in London if they're powerful. So, for example, all the bishops have palaces here. So the Bishop of Winchester has a summer palace on the South Bank. Bishop of Ely owns Ely Place, and it's, like, just kind of outside of the city courts. You have all of the bishops who are kind of constantly coming here. You'll have townhouses for all of the rich nobles who have to come here in order to see the king. Anyone who's anyone has a foothold here. As part of this also, there is, of course, a pretty thriving Jewish community after the Normans take over, because the Normans invite the Jewish community in order to do money lending and really kind of get this thing cranking, right? Because you're going to need that. But then they all get chased out about 200 years later for anti-Semitic reasons. And that is one of the things, like, chasing all the Jewish people out is possibly one of the reasons that they never get to be quite as big as, you know, Paris does. But basically, you could say, you know, before we move on to Paris, by 1300, there is a population of about 80,000 people in London. In 1100, the population was around about 15,000. So that 200 years, like, think about that. It's like, we are talking about it more than quadrupling in size in 200 years. This, you know, we've talked about the guilds in the past. You know, that's, you know, a big part of it. They have these self-determination things. They have special taxation rules. It is also kind of used as, like, the king's piggy bank. Like, if he wants a loan, he'll, like, make London give him a loan and shit like that. But it's this weird case, and it's really kind of like a big part of that is building on from Roman things, but at the same time, like, doing something weird and completely different. But it's really the Normans that kick it off. The early English were not doing much with it, to be honest.
Yeah. One thing I do find interesting about London, around 1100, it had, you know, as Eleanor said, you know, between 10 and 20,000 people, which meant at the time it was about the same size as the largest North American indigenous settlement north of Mexico, which is a place called Cahokia, which is in modern day Illinois. Yeah, I just always find that.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Cahokia was, I think, abandoned in the 1200s. If I'm off about that, I apologize. I've been there once. It was really cool. When I was younger. Yeah, but that's my thing. Yeah.
Wow. So no, that's really cool.
London was the same size as, a bunch of Indian mound or Native American mounds in Illinois. Yeah, so there you go.
It's quite interesting, right, too, because like in terms of those sizes, because that's about also this, like Prague's around the same size as London at that point in 1100, and then it's just like, wow, like London really takes off. I mean, Prague gets up to, we think, maybe by the 14th century, like maybe 60,000 or so, but like London's always a bit bigger. Some people say that it gets up to 80,000 people, but I think that that's just some Czech nationalism at work, if I'm being honest. But I mean, Prague was big. I want to make that clear. It's just that like London's a weird example because it's all wool trade. I mean, like, sorry, I forgot to mention that it's all wool trade. It's all wool trade, guys. Were you worried that I wouldn't talk about the wool trade in this episode? Don't worry. Wool trade.
Yes.
Half the guilds just doing wool shits.
Yep. And so from London, we then turn to
gay Paris.
Parisi? What was that? Is that what it was called back in the day? Lutetia. That's what it was. Lutetia.
Yeah.
It's a Roman Lutetia, which was built on a big swamp in central France.
Yeah. And it's very funny because it's called Lutetia, but like the first inhabitants, but there was still like a bunch of people living around there who were Gaulish, and they are called the Parisi. Mm. And so that's where it comes from. Mm-hmm. And the Parisi were no joke. They were like trading with like down into the Iberian Peninsula. They were trading with Eastern Europe. They minted their own coins. And then like the Romans were like, oh shit, well, we better conquer these people. They established Lutetia. There's a column dedicated to Mercury that we found kind of like under the choir of Notre Dame. which again shows you what medieval people do, right? Lutetia is on what we call the left bank now, and that's because it's got higher elevation and there's less flooding there. So they had a forum and everything, and then like basically they have like the governors have their residence, but the governors have their residence on the Île de la Cité. Okay, so the Île de la Cité is, you know, the island in the middle where Notre Dame and stuff is. And the Roman governors were living around where the Palais de Justice is now, and then, like, that's where their deal is. Mm-hmm. They, you know, kind of fuck off and collapse. But basically, it's just such a rich place and well-connected that it doesn't really collapse in the same way that London does. So, like, the Romans aren't there, but everyone is like, oh, okay, well, we're staying here. Because the point is that it's got an incredible location, right? So it's it's on the confluence of the Seine, obviously, but also the Loire. I watch Eleanor absolutely butcher French. The Marne and the Yerre. And it's got a fucking killer food supply from everywhere around the region. And the fastest way to move things in and out is, you know, always by water. Shipping is the fastest way to move in the medieval period. So it's just like hooked up like for grain fields, vineyards, things like that. And all of these rivers mean that you can also get through them to everywhere else in France, right? And you can get as far as Spain. You can get as far as Germany by traversing just the rivers. So that's, you know, incredible, right? And the Seine at Paris was about twice as wide as it is now that there's like flood protection in place and everything, right? And the tributary, Bièvre, I think is how you say it, kind of like came in there, and like then you've got the Île de la Cité in the middle. And so the Île de la Cité is incredibly important because it was the easiest place to build bridges to get across the Seine. So if you're coming from Orléans, or you're coming from Flanders, or you're coming from like one of these, you know, big populated places, that's where you pretty much have to cross, because that's the only place that there's bridges. And then also, it's really easy to defend the island because it's a fucking island, right? So everyone is like, okay, yeah. we'll build some walls up here. And this comes in handy because, like, it does get attacked. So it's attacked by the Huns in the 5th century. Mm-hmm. It's attacked by the Vikings in the 9th century. And the Vikings fucking chill in the 9th century attack. They're just there for, like, months on end. Mm. And it's quite wild. But, like, interestingly, it's always kind of, like, an important place. And it's an important trading town. But it really comes up. It's very, very similar. Like, this is the interesting thing. And this is why I've put London and Paris together. Is because, like, their starts are similar because it's Roman. But also, one of the big things about them is they become even more important when they get connected to a dynasty of kings. And see, the difference is that in Paris, it starts sooner. Eh? So in Paris, it becomes like the big deal under the Capetian dynasty, who come in the 10th century. So they rule France between 987 and 1328, and then you get your Hundred Years' War, right? And so it is, you know, and you know, having said that, there were still like really important church things that were there. So you have like the Abbey of Saint Victor and the Abbey of Saint Genevieve, and the Abbey of Saint Germain des Prés, which is like, you know, Saint Germain is still a quarter, right? And these are all incredibly important monasteries, and they're really, really important. Like, they have connections to Charlemagne. They've got all kinds of things like that. They're some of the big copying monasteries. So there's important stuff going on there. I'm not saying that there wasn't. But when the Capetians come in, they're like, okay, well, this is a royal seat, and this is where administration happens. And that's like the magic for cities, right? So they build a castle on top of where the Roman one was, because, you know, that's the done thing. They're like, look, here we are, the rulers. We're just like the Romans. Mm-hmm. Hugh Capet, he is the first one. He's elected king of the French in 987, and he stays in the castle, right? Other Capetian kings don't necessarily stay there as much. They'll have like royal they've got like royal residences in like Orléans and Compiègne, Versailles, like everywhere. But the point is, the administration and archives kind of go where the king goes, but the kings always come back to Paris because of these important things. Then you get a series of important kings that really like fucking go for it. So you get Robert the Pious, who's like from 996. I mean, he really likes Paris. And so he like spends a lot of time like rebuilding the castle. Like, he makes it like an absolutely big one. So it's kind of like 110 by 135 meters, which is really, really crazy. He builds a St. Nicholas chapel because he really likes St. Nicholas. I also like St. Nicholas, so I'm excited about that. But then in the 12th century, when you've got Louis VI and Louis VII, then it becomes the principal residence of the kings, where they're like, I have had enough of this, like, dicking around and, like, moving to the other castles. Like, nope, that's just it. We are here. And they make the Palais de la Cité, or, you know, the royal palace, or the palace of the city, like, the major place. So Philip II puts archives there. And like, that's a really big deal, right? So it's like, okay, the administration is staying here. We, instead of the administrative stuff following a king around wherever he may go, there is a disestablished archive, and this is where things can be. And like, this is why we've got great records for these motherfuckers, right? So, you know, there's a treasury in there. They've got multiple courts. And so then it's like, this is definitively like the capital of France by about 1180, right? Okay.
Yeah.
So the seat of royal power is always on the Île de la Cité. But then, like, the religious authority is quite interesting, right? Because, like, Notre Dame is obviously a really big fucking deal, right? And it's always, it's doing the classic church thing of it owns a lot of the city of Paris, right? But there were already these other important cloisters around. But once you get a cathedral, it's like, oh, wow. Like, that's like, now we're a city, right? So they've got a cloister that occupies like most of the area of the island to the north of where the cathedral is. But it's not like a normal cloister, right? It's just where monks live. It's kind of like a city in a city where most of the clerics live and work. And the thing about having that is that when does Paris invent the university? Oh, the 11th century. Right. So it's like, yeah, you can make an argument that like Bologna is first. Like, I mean, yeah. Okay. So Bologna is probably first, but it's quite interesting because Bologna, the university started because students kind of demand it. In Paris, the church starts it. Eh? And so it's like, oh, there's already all these places where clerics can live. There's already this whole like walled off community where we can keep an eye on all these rowdy students. Here we go. So, you know, for example, when Abelard is doing his thing in Paris and being a dickhead and interrupting other people's fucking lectures and getting his dick and balls chopped off and whatever the else, like he hadn't studied in Paris. He'd studied in Lyon. And like by then the other cathedral schools suddenly all empty into Paris, and then Paris is this really big center for university life, and it becomes like the place that you go to study philosophy. So if you want to study philosophy, you've got to go to Paris. So you know, like, this is, you know, your standard trivium quadrivium. We've talked all about it before, you don't need to hear it again. But the cathedral school in Paris, like slash the University of Paris, produces 7 popes, 29 cardinals, Louis the VII, the nephews of Pope Alexander, Abelard was there, Maurice de Sully was there, Pierre Lombard were there, Thomas Aquinas was there, Saint Bonaventure was there. Like, basically the University of Paris is just like where the fuck it's at if what you're talking about is theologians. So like I spend all my time reading about these motherfucking guys, right? And it's because the church was able to kind of dominate this piece of land that is so closely connected, you know, in all these different ways. So basically, like, you know, other colleges kind of like come up like around the point, but, you know, jointly, it's still the University of Paris. So it's like it starts in Notre Dame. But what happens is that Notre Dame is so big that other schools kind of like start up, and that makes the University of Paris. And that is what is now the Sorbonne. Right. And so like it gets chartered in 1200, and like that's you know the deal. So really, really big deal. So if you want to like learn about philosophy, that's where you have to go. So meanwhile, the left bank it's still got like all of the big monasteries, as I say. But then you also have like the Abbey of Saint Laurent gets made there, and then very, very interestingly, if you're me, It is known as like a center for illuminated manuscripts. So So a lot of the texts that we have all come out from like the left bank, because it's like you've got Abbey of Saint Genevieve, you've got like, you know, there's like 7 monasteries over there. Like, and they're just all, and they're like having a manuscript off, you know, and so, and then, so they make so many manuscripts that like a lot of the sources that we have that survive are also, it's like, you've got 2 ways of source survival for Paris. You've got, you know, the archives of the kings, and then you've got all of these manuscripts that are getting made. So like clerics make up such a massive, like part of the, you know, population. That, like, we think by the 14th century, like, in 1300, about 20,000 people in the city were members of religious orders. So that's about... And then to give you an idea of how big Paris is, that's 10% of the population. So you know how I was just like, oh, London, that's 80,000 people? It's 200,000 people. 200,000 people in Paris. Big fucking deal. Yeah. Paris is a big fucking deal. It's a huge goddamn city. And it's like the only other cities that are as big as it are like Italian ones. It's absolutely enormous. Like, right. So that's the left bank. The left bank is all of your, that's why it's called the Latin Quarter now, is because of all of the monasteries that, you know, and they were speaking Latin. No? Right. So it's like, oh, right. So the right bank, meanwhile, that's like the commercial part of the city. So that's like where you get all of your markets, you get your artisans, you get all sorts of stuff like that. Right. You know, this presents a problem, right? Because obviously now Paris is larger than just the Ile de la Cité. So they have to, in 1180, they have to build a new set of walls, right? They're like, oh, shit, like, this is not great. So Philip II is like, okay, that's it. We've got to, we're going to have to build new walls. So the work begins kind of in 1190. It takes, you know, 18 years or so. And it's basically, the new wall is 5,400 meters long. And it's got 10 gates. It's got 75 towers. And it surrounds 273 hectares. And there's still, like, gardens and pastures and stuff to, like, feed people. But, it's... you know, like, it's a city. But it's really quite interesting because it continues to kind of suck people in, right? So, you have new investment then comes along as a bit. So my favorite thing in Paris, and what I'm always telling people to go to, is the Saint-Chapelle, which is made to basically advertise how incredibly fancy the King of France is, right? So basically within that, they collect most of the relics that are in France, and they put them all in there. They make these huge stained glass windows that are like 3 stories high. They're absolutely fucking incredible. It's just like absolutely wild. And it's this specific symbol, not only of like holiness and like the holiness that's connected to the throne, but also like the power of France and like, look what I can make. And that's the first Gothic style building, right? So it's like, well, yeah, okay, maybe it's not the first one, but it's like the first one where we're like, this is a really, really big deal, right? And then everyone is like, oh shit, the French kings did what? Now we gotta make a church, like, you know, and then like that, and then like the Gothic style. Like, so they're all like consciously they are trying to be Parisians, right? So like that, and that was built by Louis the Ninth, and so he later becomes Saint Louis, which you know, several cities are named after. You may have heard of him. And like basically that becomes like a really big deal. Moving on kind of like into the 13th century, you have Philip IV, who does a bunch of work of like making the palace much nicer. And like here, it's quite interesting because like he starts spending a lot of money on having his own scriptorium. So it's like it's like a manuscript arms race. So like the king is manuscripts as well.
I like that.
And then like, so by the 14th century, like all these things, right? You've got these big walls, and as a result, Paris has to start like building up, right? Because they're moving into the vacant bits. They're moving into where all the gardens and stuff are there. But then suddenly like Charles V is like, okay, well we have to build another wall that's like 4,900 meters long. So it's like, it just makes the city so much bigger again. And it's just like incredibly, it's become so much bigger. But importantly for fans of the proletariat, this new move means that there is a new fortress built at the Port Saint-Antoine called the Bastille. And so that's in the city, right?
You might have heard of it.
And then that's it. That's it in terms of what the walls are. There, no new walls are kind of like built until the 16th century. Like that. That's it. And so like the city can't grow out anymore, so it starts growing up, right? So you have like really tiny little streets, all that good shit that, you know, nerds like me jack off over. Like the average house in the 14th century is like, you know, at least 4 stories tall. So it's like you'll have a ground floor, you got like 2 floors of residential space, you got an apartment that you rent out on like the fourth floor, you know, stuff like that. And then this is kind of like where our idea of the townhouse comes from, is like Paris, right? So like, and this is kind of like what remains, like, you know, this is kind of like what the city stays like until kind of like the Reconstruction by Napoleon III in the 19th century, where they're like, it is way too easy for these MFers to just throw barricades up. Right. And they get really annoyed by how many barricades do be getting put up. And then they're like, OK, that's it. Like, clear it all out. And then that's why you get all the wide boulevards and stuff that you have now is to stop the French, who are quite unruly. I know we've talked about this before, but everybody just look at the French and actually take note about the fact that they just fucking riot about anything. They're like, you mildly inconveniencing them, and they're throwing a Molotov cocktail, and that's why they still have like, and there, even underneath their feckless leader Macron at the moment, they have just kind of like nationalized the major energy company EDF. So like, learn something from them. Become the problem. Become the reason why Napoleon III wants to like rebuild your city. Right. That's all I'm saying. So, basically, it's got a lot of kind of like the hallmarks of London, right? So sort of the same things. It's like you've got this administrative center, but it's got so much more than London does, because it's like it's a huge market for luxury goods, because the French king is just like way richer, and there's a lot more rich people generally, because there's like huge like bourgeois population. So like it's a huge center of silk production. Like there are people making furs. There's like, but at this point in time, the manuscript armories gets to the point that you just have artisan shops that are making them. There's a lot of money lenders, right? So you have a thriving Jewish community there. Like basically, but having said this, there's a lot of poor people there too. So in the 13th century, about 10% of the city is paying, sorry, 15% of the city is paying taxes. Okay. And they're paying about like 80% of all taxes. And so like, and that's only about like 140 families or 2,000 people. And again, this is a city of about 200,000 people. So below this, you have like artisans and stuff. And we know a lot about like artisans, because there's this thing that was made in 1268 called the Book of Professions, or the Livre des Métiers, that like writes down what all the rules for all the various like artisans are. And like, and there's all kinds of things, like they've got like a guild for bathhouse keepers, they've got a guild for mercers, they've got a, like you name it, they got it, right? And there's about 1300 distinct Parisian professions that they write down in this book, and they all have their own separate set of rules. And like, and it's basic, but they do it to kind of like limit competition and make sure everyone's got employment, right? But about 70% of the city are, they don't make enough money to pay taxes. And like, they, it's kind of precarious, right? So as a result, Paris has a lot of things, like they're kind of like one of, because the rich, because of Catholicism and guilt, fund a lot of things there, right? So they fund a lot of hospitals, like the Hotel de Dieu is kind of like close by and things like that. And they're the ones who kind of like start the idea of like, oh yeah, there, here's the sick place that you can take people to. There's a lot of orphanages. There's a lot of hospices. There's a lot of Lazar houses, you know, things like this, because at least the wealthy then were frightened of hell. And they would like build some things. So, I mean, having said that, like it's never really great, you know, for the poor. And there's like an absolutely teeming mass of workers who are extraordinarily poor, and Paris attracts the poor from all over. So we see records, for example, of like, there's lots of English people living there, like poor English people, because they all speak fucking French, because, you know, the ruling class over in London speaks it. And it's like, if things aren't going well there, well, you could try in Paris instead, right? And like, there, as a result of this, though, like in the 15th century, kind of towards the end of the medieval period, they start getting a lot less charitable and kind of like rounding people up and throwing them out of the city if they're begging and stuff like that. But like that's kind of both of these very important medieval cities in a nutshell. But it's important to kind of think about these two things, because we tend to think about the two in one go. You know, it's like a tale of two cities, down and out, et cetera, et cetera. And we always kind of consider ourselves to be in dialogue with each other. And I mean, that's especially true after the Hundred Years' War, when, you know, the English are trying to be French again and take over things. And London manages to eclipse Paris, mostly as a function of modernity and of the fact that, like, not that the French didn't do colonialism, because boy, howdy, woo, they sure did. But, you know, London, like, you know, the English do that much more. And so modern London is kind of a result of, you know, the fact that the English were quite good at thieving. So that's why we're as large as we are. And, you know, now we're mostly a financial center. So Paris is smaller, but it's only because of basically the 19th and 20th centuries. It takes up to then for London to really kind of get away from itself. And, you know, even so, we're still always kind of like looking at Paris and feeling, you know, slightly, you know, smaller than that, right? Which is one of the things I like about London, though, is that we're really outward looking. But, you know, there's a lot of movement back and forth. But just suffice to say that if London was doing it, Paris was doing it kind of like twice as big and in a more sophisticated way. And really, you know, like like Paris is sort of like the medieval city. Like, I mean, you could argue, like, you could argue for Florence, you could argue for Venice, you know, all of which we'll talk about later. But like Paris is kind of it does kingship, it does commerce, you name it, they be doing it. And it really whips, and I think it's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to beat the cultural output of Paris as like a cultural city,
yeah.
A city of ideas and everything. You know, they did the French Revolution. They got
I love that.
They got the Louvre.
You know.
You know it's you know I mean they you know just hundreds of beautiful like medieval and you know medieval architecture and all that, and it's just like. You know, you can't beat that. Even if you get bigger, like London has, you know, if you're talking about cultural centers of the world, you know, people will probably still point to Paris, even though, you know, London is, bigger.
Yeah.
And, you know, has its fair share of culture and everything like that. But. You know, it's Paris. There's just something.
It's got that je ne sais quoi
magical about it in the mind. Yeah, it does. It has the French élan. I've never been to Europe. I think I've said that before. You know, but like when I think about them, you know, I think about London, and I'm like, yeah, that's that's where the king and queen are. Mm. You know, soccer because I love soccer. All that sort of stuff. And then when I think about Paris, I'm like, oh yeah, that's the cultural midpoint of Europe. Somehow, you know.
Yeah,
And you can and you Londoners who are listening to that and gritting your teeth while I'm saying this can take it up with pop culture, because I am an uncouth swine. So, you know, don't yell at me.
It's really interesting because I really love Paris, which is a completely unsurprising thing to say. But having said that, there's a whole thing called Paris syndrome, which is especially it's especially experienced by Japanese people, but people experience it generally, which is that they get to Paris and they're so disillusioned because it doesn't live up to their idea of what Paris would be that they essentially have a mental break. And they have to be like airlifted out. And it's really common among Japanese people. It's something like 7 people a year have to be doing. And I'm really interested in syndromes. Like there's a similar one for Jerusalem, which we'll probably have to do Jerusalem in this as well. But there's a thing called Jerusalem syndrome where people go to Jerusalem and then they begin to think that they are like saints and they have kind of like religious ecstasies. And and they have like a mental break that way.
That's amazing. I guess that one makes more sense to me. Like, I don't believe in it, but that makes more sense to me. But like you go to Paris and you're like, this beautiful Baroque architecture is not Baroque.
Yeah, they're
enough.
Like, oh, I hate it. But it's quite funny because I think that they're sort of like reacting to the fact that it's a big city. Right. And I was sort of protected by that. Cause when I moved to London, it's quite funny. I'd never been to London before. And I was just like, well, I'm going to do my PhD there. Okay. Like, bye. Well, I'm just going to do it. And I went to Paris shortly thereafter. And I'd already lived, you know, in the Czech Republic all over for ages. And I'd been to Italy and I'd been to Spain and Germany and, you know, all these places. But I just like didn't go to Paris because I was living in Prague. And so it just seemed really expensive. Mm. And I basically had no illusions because I'd heard people be like, Paris isn't that good. Nah. And I was like, okay, my expectations were low. And I got there and I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? This town whips. Like, are you saying like it's just so good for we were fucking broke as hell at the time and just bought like a bottle of port in a grocery store and walked around to various like pretty locations in Paris and like drank port. Like it got it taken off us at the Eiffel Tower and the security guard held our bottle of port for us down the bottom and gave it back to us. And I was like, this town is great. Brilliant.
Oh man, that is quintessentially French right there. They cork and hold your
wine. Yeah, it's fucking great, man. Love that town. Recommended. And I mean, I suppose that there's one more historical thing to say here is that probably the reason also that Paris is so big and interesting and enchanting and, you know, all the things that we like about it also has to do with the fact that like kingship in France collates really much sooner than in a lot of other places. You know, like when I say, like everything takes off when the Capetians are there. It's like, yeah, but everything kind of takes off also because like there's a contiguous idea of the Kingdom of France at that point. Right. There isn't in one of England in the same way.
No.
You know, like you've still got Vikings every five seconds and it's like, where's the Danelaw? things like that. It's like, oh shit, we got Vikings again. Damn, you know, and Paris doesn't have that problem. They can just go, oh, okay, well, this is France, and there's like a king who's like sucking in all of the kind of patronage from the nobility, and that it like allows Paris to do what it does.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you're gonna be slightly behind because, you know, while Paris was already a thing, was already a kind of, you know, like a central city, you know, some French guys from one of the backwater coastal areas came over and took over England and turned it into like little France for a while. So like you can't like that's a tough thing to come back from in terms of like, you know, okay, like, you know, we're the equal of power, or whatever. Like it takes a long time to recover.
Exactly. It's like you've got, oh, you let the French Vikings take you over, right? It's like, that's, you know, I love the Normans. They're like, what, answering the question, what if a Viking was French? They're like, they're also going to take over London, because like, it's just there was never a Viking that didn't try to take over London. I'll tell you that much. So, right.
Nope. Not a single time. Nah.
They were less successful in Paris. They did not care. They were less successful in Paris. There you go.
Yeah. There you go. Well, thank you so much for listening to the show today. Thank you for indulging us there at the beginning.
I don't know, man. My life is weird. Meantime, yeah. Sorry, everybody.
Yeah, it's fucking weird. Times are weird here. Yeah. Eleanor, where can the people find you talking about the
world? Oh, yeah. Like, I'm mostly Boris posting at the moment. So if you want to hear it, I'm at Going Medieval at Twitter. My blog is going-medieval.com. I owe a kink article, but I'm so distracted by Boris that I don't know. And of course, you can always still pick up my comic book, The Middle Ages, A Graphic History, wherever cool books by awesome chicks are sold.
That's right. And my name is Luke. You can find me on Twitter at Luke is Amazing. You can find my other show, A People's History of the Old Republic, which is about Star Wars, wherever you're listening to this. Again, thank you so much for listening. Check out the Patreon if you haven't. And we'll see you next time.
Bye.